Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening, welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Melody Razak, who owned a cake shop in Brighton for 8 years, then went back to university to do an MA in creative writing when she was 40. She enjoyed the course so much she decided to sell her business and pursue a writing career. Her debut novel, Moth, is set in 1940s Delhi and was inspired by her love affair with India. It was written on long train journeys across the country. Also with us is Nicole Kennedy, who grew up in Essex and was the first person in her family to go to university, studying law. She's always wanted to be a novelist, but her work as a lawyer left little time for writing. During her second maternity leave, she began writing poems about motherhood and family life, which she posted on her blog, The Brightness of These Days. Her debut novel, Everything's Perfect, was written during her third maternity leave. It explores themes of motherhood, female friendship, and the quest for perfection in an Instagram age. We also have Jean Fullerton, who was born and grew up in East End of London within the sound of Bow Bells in Whitechapel. She's a qualified district and Queen's nurse and also worked as a teacher lecturing on nursing studies at a London university. She now writes full-time and is the author of 19 historical novels. Her latest in the Ration Book series is A Ration Book Daughter, set in World War II London. Finally, on tonight's book show is Kat Dunn, who grew up in London and has lived in Japan, Australia and France. She's written about mental health for Mind and The Guardian and worked as a translator for Japanese television. Her latest book, Monstrous Design, is a young adult fantasy novel. Kat is passionate about protecting the mental health of young adults and ensuring queer voices are heard. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Melody Razak, who owned a cake shop in Brighton for 8 years called Treacle & Co. and most recently worked as a pastry chef at London-based restaurant Honey & Co. She went back to university to do her MA in creative writing when she was 40 years old and enjoyed the course so much that she made the heartbreaking decision to sell her business and pursue a writing career. She's with us on the book show now to talk about her debut novel. It's called Moth, which was inspired by her ongoing love affair with India and was written on long train journeys across the country. Welcome to the book show, Melody.
Thank you for having me.
It must be very exciting and very weird for you to now have your book out after selling your business and putting all your life and your money and your thoughts into writing books.
Yeah, do you know, it's really quite wonderful. It's overwhelming and wonderful and a little bit painful because it's just so exciting. And I'm hoping it's just the start of a lot more books and a lot more writing. So it feels like I'm on the cusp of something quite exciting.
Oh, wonderful. So tell me why you decided to do the MA in creative writing, first of all. What inspired that?
Sure. I've always been a huge reader, always, especially as a little girl, always losing myself in books, always wrote little stories here and there, and had this like faraway dream, I guess, when I was a child that one day I was going to be a writer. And it's one of those things that you think and then you put it away because you think, well, that's never going to happen. But I'm, you know, always going to imagine that one day I'll be a writer. And as I was approaching 40 and I kept a journal. I was in India for a month. I was traveling around and I was keeping a diary and I was writing every day. And I was writing so much and enjoying it so much. I thought that I would look into doing a course of some kind, and then came upon the MA decided to just go for it and to do that part time whilst working at the same time. And just got on with it so well that wanted to explore it further.
Wow. So selling the business must have been a big, big decision.
It was. But, you know, I think I'd got to that point in my life where I'd been a chef for 20 years. I'd had the business for 10 years because I had it 2 years from home and then 8 years in the actual cafe. And I must have wanted a change at some kind of deep root level. And I must have wanted some way of expanding my world and traveling and thinking and writing. And so I think the MA was the first step into acknowledging that I needed to change something in my life. Yeah.
So tell me about your trip around India. You did it on your own, didn't you? Although sometimes you pretended to have a husband and a
yes.
son.
So. Yeah, I had to every now and again, if I'd been on a long train journey and, you know, you start talking to the way that the trains are in India, you get a cabin, and in your cabin, there'll be like two or three other beds, sometimes six beds. And you end up chatting to the people who share that cabin with you. And they'd always be saying, where's your husband? Why don't you have children? And it just was a lot easier to pretend that I had a husband and a child, because it just to create that bit of distance. And then I felt a bit more protected by that. Mm. Yeah.
Did you always feel safe? I mean, did you ever get into any difficult situations when
No.
you were there? Oh, that's
no,
good.
I mean, it was my fifth trip to India, so I have spent a lot of time there. I'm very familiar with how things work. I'm very familiar with the transport, with the country. And on this trip, when I took the year out to write the novel, I decided to go to my favourite places, places that I'd been to a few times that I knew very well. You know, even went back to some of the guest houses that I went to when I was backpacking in my 20s. So it was lovely to sort of dip back into that world again, and just felt very comfortable, traveling around on my own.
Yeah, good. And you spent a lot of time by the Ganges and became obsessed with watching cremations.
I did. I love, my favourite place in India is Varanasi. And I don't know if you know much about it, but it's a holy town and the Ganges runs through it. And a lot of Hindus go there to perform rituals, and a lot of them go there to see out when they're coming close to death. They, you know, they go out there to die so that they can be cremated near the Ganges. And there's many, there's quite a few different cremation sites along it. And so I became quite fascinated by just walking along the Ganges every day for a couple of hours, and then going and standing by these cremation sites where you can actually watch the cremations. And it just was just quite a hypnotic, beautiful ritual to be allowed to watch someone else's family grieving for them, and watch them being put on the pyre and the pyre burning, and, you know, the heat of the fire, and obviously the heat of Varanasi itself. You know, I was there at one point, it was like 40 degrees or something, and then you have the heat of the fire, the heat of the city, and I don't know, you feel very close to some kind of something quite important, though. You're not always sure what it is, some kind of essence. You feel that you're you know, you could almost touch it. So
yeah.
It felt very magical and very important for me to be there.
Yeah. And I understand there was quite a bit of inspiration that came to you for the book Moth, listening to a Radio 4 program.
Yeah, that's right. It was a Radio 4 program, Partition Voices. And it was one evening when I was working late at the cafe, and I started to hear it was a program that they'd done, a project where they basically interviewed a few of the remaining survivors of partition. And these are people who are well into their 80s, you know, so they were the last voices of people who'd actually experienced that rupture in India. And hearing some of their stories, I was very moved by it. But I was also very moved by the fact that I started thinking about how, you know, especially women, when they're interviewed, they might tell you a story, but you wonder how much are they not actually telling you. You know, how many of the more intimate facts are they leaving out because maybe their husband's in the room, or maybe they don't want to feel the shame of it. And then I started doing a bit of reading that summer at the British Library. And I came across this great book called The Other Side of Silence by a woman called Avashi Bhutalia, who's a Indian feminist and publisher. And her family were involved in partition, and she created this project of interviewing some of her family members. And just showing that there was a lot of silence, you know, and a lot of women were raped and abducted, and a lot of these women had children that they then, on the other side of it, had to give up their children in order to be accepted back into their families. And none of these women's stories were ever told, and these women never spoke about it. And that felt to me very devastating that it's such a huge part of history and so trodden upon, you know, and so like quiet, so that, you know, most people don't know that this is what happened.
Yeah. And you hear stories through what happened in history very differently when it's told by a man compared to by a woman.
Exactly. And I found it very interesting when I was doing my research. I was reading newspaper articles of the time, say like the Hindustani Times or the Times of India. Then I was reading the historical books. Then I was reading some fictional work, and then reading a few essays, and most of it, you know, 90% written by men. And I really felt there was a space, especially in fiction, there was a space to explore the lives of these women who really took on such a lot of the brunt of the ruptures of the time.
Mm. And when you were doing your research for the book, that was when you realised that your father was actually born in India.
Yeah, I mean, I knew, like, my father's Pakistani, and I'm not in touch with my father, and not since I was a child. But when I came to apply for my because I applied for a 5-year Indian visa, and I had to get my birth certificate from my mum, and it said father born in India, and I'd never clocked the two, that obviously, you know, he was of the age where he would have been, you know, his family would have moved during partition to Pakistan. So that was very interesting. Unfortunately, I'm not really in touch with that side of the family so much. But it did give me an even greater incentive to want to explore that period.
And the family in the book, Moth, are very kind of female strong, which is what the family that you grew up in.
That's right. Yeah, I grew up with my mum and my little sister, and Iranians being what they are, they're very generous and they're very hospitable. So we always had so many cousins, aunts, friends, so many people constantly staying with us or coming through the house. And so you have that kind of rich female energy that we grew up in, and I kind of wanted to celebrate that, because it's quite extraordinary to have that in your life, and it does need to be celebrated, I think.
Yeah. So looking at the book Moth, tell us about the main characters.
Okay, so we have a 15-year-old girl called Alma, who is about to get married, and she's just on that cusp of adolescence, where she's very romantic, and she's fantasizing about having, she's met this boy once, and she's fantasizing about their marriage. She even creates a fantasy of him in her brain, in her imagination, where she's has these conversations with him. I guess it's the main character, though the novel is also told through the points of views of the other characters. And then you have Ma and Bapu. They're Alma's parents. They're intellectuals and they're lecturers at Delhi University. I specifically wanted them to be intellectuals because I wanted them to be able to question the politics, to have political discussions, to read the newspapers, because it was very important for me that the novel concentrates not only on the intimate stories of this family, but also on the historical background. So it was important that the family were able to engage with the political side of things as well. And then we have Alma's little sister, Roop. Roop is a wonderful character because she's obsessed by death. She's obsessed by blood. She's obsessed by killing things. And she's very much a product, I think, of her times, because if you grew up, if you're born and grew up in an atmosphere where murder and death and mass killings are quite prominent, and there's always that looming threat of what's going to happen next in the air, so if you're born in that kind of era, then you take on the characteristics. So I wanted her to be a child of those times, but she was a wonderful character to write. Dadi Ma, the grandmother, is another very interesting character because she is a very, very strict Hindu. And she is also, she might look at times that she's being very cruel or very bigoted, but actually she's also a product of her childhood where you realise she's suffered quite a lot. So she's had to hold on to religion as a way to kind of help her, to, you know, to see through it.
Fascinating. All very, very different characters, all rich characters.
Yeah. I specifically wanted the characters to all have a different voice because one of the things that struck me when I was doing my research, I kept reading the phrase, the many voices of partition, and I kept coming across this over and over again, which made me realise that to tell the story as truthfully as I could, I'd need to have so many different points of view because everyone was affected in a different way by a partition, and I wanted to kind of capture a general feeling of the time, and so you have all these different voices in it.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea. So you've obviously done a massive amount of research for the book.
Yes, it took me about 3 months to do the research. I was literally in the British Library every day to the point where the security guards knew which lunch, you know, which bag I carried my lunch in and would always comment on my lunch and stuff like that. Yeah,
it was lovely.
It was really, really good.
So was it difficult to kind of tear yourself away from the research? You know, did you know when it was time to stop and start writing, or did you have to keep going back to it, or...?
Well, you know, I did all the research when I was in London. I stayed at my mum's for 3 months and did all the research. And then I knew the research had to stop when I went to India because then, I said to myself, I'm going to have a year in India and I'm going to give myself a year to write the novel. So it was my mission that I wasn't allowed to come back to England until I had written the novel. And I had to come back with a complete first draft. So as soon as I got to India, that's when I started. And because I'd never tried to do such a big project. I mean, it's very, very overwhelming when you first begin to write a novel. You think, where do I even start, you know? And so I had to be really strict in those first few weeks and months trying to work out what my writing schedule was, what worked best for me, until I kind of got myself into a rhythm, and then the writing just flowed really beautifully after that.
Oh, wonderful. So is it the start of many, do you think? Is this the first of many books?
I hope so. At the moment, I'm doing the third draft of my second novel. So I'm hoping that should be finished by the end of the summer. And I have several other writing projects, some nonfiction work and another novel idea that I want to research and think about. So, yeah, I'm hoping this will be me for the next 20, 30 years.
Oh, exciting. So no regrets so far?
No regrets. No regrets. I do sometimes walk past the place that was my cafe and I always feel this like pang, but it's fine. I really, really love writing, so it more than makes up for it.
Yeah, you'll just have to have a slice of your cake at home whilst you're writing.
exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's been lovely to chat with you, Melody Razak. Thanks so much for joining us. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Moth and it's available on our website. Can I just ask you about the title,
sure.
Moth? What's the relevance?
Yes. So Moth, one of the... when I was doing my research again, one of the it was Muhammad Jinnah, who was the prime minister that then became the prime minister of the Muslim League Party that then became Pakistan. When they were offered Pakistan at partition, one of the things he said was that India had become moth-eaten. So you can imagine what was the continent of India. Then they divided it. So you had Pakistan to the left and Bangladesh to the right. So it was as if it kind of was like a jumper with big holes in it rather than one whole thing. And so the moth-eaten came from that political language. But it also came from the fact that I can imagine just something full of holes, you know, something that needs mending, that kind of that falls apart.
Yeah.
And but what was really interesting, and I think what really drove me to pick that title was that summer when it was the summer when I decided to write the book, that I had a moth infestation in my flat and they ate all my clothes.
Oh no.
Yeah, to the point where I was picking up scarves, wool scarves, and they were literally like falling apart in my hands. And I threw out bin bags, all my woolen clothes, all everything that, you know, that you could imagine, bin bags and bin bags of clothes. And it was such a traumatic moment.
Oh, yes.
Just watching these clothes disintegrate. And that image really stuck with me. And then as I was reading about partition and India and all the different religions and the tribes and ethnicities within India that were all then ruptured during partition, then the moth image and the scarf falling apart in my hands.
Yeah, perfect.
Really was absolutely perfect, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, it's lovely to chat with you and best of luck with moth.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you so much.
This is the Talk Radio Europe Book Show with Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Nicole Kennedy, who grew up in Essex and was the first person in her family to go to university when she won a place to study law at Bristol. She's always wanted to be a novelist, but her work as a lawyer left little time for writing. During Nicole's second maternity leave, she began writing poems and rhymes on motherhood and family life, which she posted to her blog, The Brightness of These Days. She completed her first novel during her third maternity leave. She's with us on the book show to talk about Everything's Perfect. It asks whether you can ever have the perfect life. It's a smart and thought-provoking romantic comedy about motherhood, friendship, and the quest for perfection in an Instagram age. Welcome to the book show, Nicole.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Thanks so much for joining us. And congratulations. How does it feel now writing novels?
It's good. It's really strange. You know, I got my book deal January 2020. So it's been a long time coming. It always feels like just a bit of a relief to finally have it out there.
Oh, I bet. And had you sort of dreamt of being a novelist for a while? Do you feel like it's been a long time coming for you?
I mean, I was one of those children, you know, with a head always stuck in a book and making up stories and making up little books of my own. So I remember as a child formalising the idea that I would become a writer. But then, I mean, I did, you know, you started working and had a family and, it was starting to feel like it would never happen. And I had a bit of a it's now or never moment after the birth of my third son. And that really pushed me to get going.
Yeah. Oh, well done. You can be proud of yourself now.
Yeah, I am. It's been a long road.
yeah. And do you think writing poems and rhymes and things kind of helped you? Was that a good grounding?
Yeah, I think it was. I realised when I was having my maternity leave that kind of when I was working as a lawyer, I was working in corporate finance and working long hours, and it kind of switched off my creative brain in a way. And I'd think of ideas for books and I'd read, but I wouldn't actually do any writing. But then I would find on my maternity leaves, suddenly I'd get these, you know, almost kind of like waves of creativity where I would just feel really compelled. I mean, the rhymes would just come into my head, and for a long time I just kind of wrote them down in the notes section of my phone and didn't do anything with them. But then I showed a few to my sister and she said, oh, why don't you know, blog them. So it really sort of unlocked my creativity again, starting with the poems and the blog. And also I started to take time for myself to do that, which I wasn't doing before. And once I'd kind of got into the rhythm of that and almost kind of gave myself permission to, you know, spend an hour a day doing something that I really enjoyed, it meant that then kind of swerved some of the mum guilt that comes with trying to do something for yourself when you've got small children at home.
Yeah. So looking at the book then, Everything's Perfect, it's about two women, Cassie and Beth. What can you tell us about them?
So Cassie is an Insta mum at the height of her fame. She is someone who appears to have it all together, but as the book progresses, you realise that that's not the case. Beth is a new mum who's struggling with anxiety and is very anti-social media, and the two meet and form an unlikely friendship because they're quite different, but their friendship is threatened when their online and offline worlds collide.
Hmm. Interesting. And do you know where the kind of inspiration for this story came from?
Yeah, so I was feeding my younger son in the middle of the night. I'd been working on a different story while I was pregnant with him, and the voice of Cassie kind of came to me. But he was 3 months old, and I had a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so I couldn't really do much. So I made a note of it, and it just kept playing in my mind. I kept thinking about it. So 2 months later in September, my oldest son, the 4-year-old, he then started school, and my middle son went to preschool a couple of mornings a week. So I really dedicated that time when my younger son was napping. That's when I started to write, and I set myself a target of writing 1,000 words a day and got into the rhythm that way. But the story did not come to me fully formed, because it has changed a lot, but the characters came to me very quickly, and I really felt like I needed to do something with them.
Mm. And it's interesting, the whole concept of a perfect life, especially looking through the world of Instagram, because it's very easy to look at photographs on Instagram and think people have the perfect life, whether it's to do with the perfect body, the perfect partner, the perfect children, you know, everything can look really great on Instagram, but as we all know, it hardly ever is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing, isn't it? Because, I mean, I've written a book about it, and I'm very conscious of it. And yet I still fall into that trap myself sometimes. You know, it's, you know, for me, I'll look at other authors and think, oh, God, maybe I should be doing that. Or look, you know, they got that opportunity. Why didn't I get that? And I have to really, you know, check myself and be like, you know, it's not real. So why does it bother you? I'm definitely getting better as I get older, and I'm really grateful that social media wasn't around when I was like a teenager. I think I'd have really struggled with that. But I think for all of us, it's a bit of a work in progress.
Yeah, definitely. Good for you for admitting that. I'm the same. I think most women are, definitely. I mean, men as well, of course, but I think it's really hard not to, you know, if you're following whoever you're following, whether they're celebrities or people who you just find interesting or enjoy the photography, travel, fashion, whatever. It's really easy to think that people look great. You know, a lot of the times with these photographs, they've got a whole team of people. They've got professional makeup artists, people doing their hair. They've got exactly the right lighting, probably a load of filters, and people editing and airbrushing out any blemishes and things like that. So the photos so often really aren't real.
Yeah, I mean, it's 1 second in their day as well, isn't it? You know, like, that's the thing that we forget. We take it to be representative of the whole of their day, and it's not. It's literally 1 second where they've had to smile or, I don't know, gaze off moodily into the distance, but it's not representative of how their lives really are.
Yeah. And I read something, I can't remember how many it was, but for one photograph, seemingly perfect photograph on Instagram, there are thousands of photographs that are taken that were discarded.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I have a very small following on Instagram, but, you know, I do post on it. And I think for every just one of mine, there's probably 30 dud ones that I've tried just before I've managed to get one that I don't feel, that I feel happy with putting online. So, yeah, I mean, I can easily see how that happens if you're doing this professionally, and a lot more hangs on it than it does for me.
Yeah. It's interesting, the idea, the concept of the character of Beth, to have a young woman who really hates social media and has no interest in it. I imagine they're kind of few and far between these days.
Well, I don't know. I really noticed that. So I was, especially when I started writing this, I've been working in the city in London, and I, until recently, I'd lived in London, but I now live in Sevenoaks in Kent. And so few of my mum friends here are on social media. Like, they'll be on Facebook and they'll kind of have a Facebook account. They don't update that often, but they kind of, you know, use it to, you know, keep in touch with people. But very few of my friends here are on Instagram, and virtually none are on Twitter. Whereas my writer friends and the, you know, the women I'm friends with from when I was living in London are. And I do feel like there's big geographical differences with how much people engage with social media.
Yeah, I guess so. And do you feel like you have more in common and have more to talk about with the ones who are on social media, or have you not really noticed a difference?
No, I rarely notice the difference. No, every now and then there's like a big thing that blows up on Instagram and I might on the school run be like, oh, did you just see this thing? And they were just, most of the mums just look at me totally blankly, like, what are you talking about? So that's probably the only time that that doesn't happen too often. And in some ways with my book stuff, it's almost been kind of nice. You know, I've done some Insta lives with you know, some other writers recently, and I'll go, and you know, my WhatsApps are going off, like, you know, my friends from home are like, oh my god, that's so exciting. But I'll go on the school run and I mean one or two mums might be like, oh, I saw you did that thing, because they're the other mums that are on Instagram. But by and large, no one really knows, like, you know, what's going on or what I'm up to. And it's kind of nice to have that separation. And I did think about that a lot when I was writing the book. I think although I think it's probably 50-50, although half of my friends are very engaged with social media, half just, it just isn't really on their radar and they're not that interested. So I think it's still a possibility to not really be engaging with it, but it'd be interesting to see if that changes. I mean, I think it's definitely something that's here to stay. I don't think, you know, stop using it.
Yeah, absolutely. And they say write about what you know. Was it an obvious subject for you to write about motherhood and female friendships and things?
Yeah, I think so. I love reading and I read widely, and I feel like, I mean, my female friendships have been super important to me growing up. I mean, I'm really lucky that some of my closest friends are friends I've had since I was at primary school. And, you know, I've picked up friends at university and law school and working, and I feel really lucky to have a wide circle of close female friends. And in a lot of ways, I feel like, you know, they're the relationships that define you. And I don't, there are books about female friendship, but there's nowhere near as many as there are about, you know, standard romance books. So that was something I really wanted to explore, because like I said, it's something that's been really important to me, and I think there's so many nuances in female friendships that, you know, aren't often captured in books.
And it's definitely something that all women can relate to in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope so. And I've had lots of comments from people saying that they have related to it. And that, you know, as a writer, especially as a debut writer, that's really nice to hear that it's landed. So, you know, there is romance in it. You know, there is all the usual things you get in books, but the focus is very much on the women. Like, I almost think of it as a love story between the women in terms of their friendship.
Yeah. And because Cassie and Beth are so different, you're more likely to have women who can relate to one or the other, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's an unusual thing to happen, but I've had it in one or two instances where I've formed a friendship in like seconds, where I've just met someone and we've just clicked. And we might not spend that much time together, but I know whenever I'm with that friend, there's just a connection between us that, you know, like not the female equivalent, but the friendship equivalent of like love at first sight.
Yeah.
So I've had that happen to me once or twice, and I've always been really fascinated by that. You know, what is that you suddenly meet people and you just connect with them? So I wanted to touch on that as well.
Brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of Everything's Perfect, it's available now and on our website to buy, tre.radio. It's by Nicole Kennedy, who we've been chatting to. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Jean Fullerton. She was born and grew up in the East End of London within the sound of Bow Bells in Whitechapel. She's the author of 19 historical novels and is a qualified district and Queen's nurse who has spent most of her working life in the East End of London, first as a sister in charge of a team and then as a district nurse tutor. She's also a qualified teacher and spent 12 years lecturing on community nursing studies at a London university. She now writes full time and is with us on the book show to talk about her latest book in the Ration Book series. It's called A Ration Book Daughter. Welcome to the book show, Jean.
Thank you for inviting me along. It's just lovely to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Tell me a bit about your background then. How did you go from this huge career in nursing to writing books?
Well, it's a funny story, really. part of my career, as I say, I was a hands-on nurse for about 15 to 20 years. And then I became a manager within the NHS, which I don't know if anyone knows this, and I'm sure many of your listeners may have worked in the NHS, but it might be a surprise to no one to know is actually quite stressful. And when I moved up to my management post several years ago, must be about 24 years ago now, we were sent on stress management courses.
Wow.
I've never really thought that I could actually write. I've always been a reader. I'm actually dyslexic as well. So English for me at school was a bit of a torture. So the thought of me actually earning my living as a by the published word is a bit ironic, really. But anyway, so they just said on this stress management course that what we should do to relieve some stress, because we were working, like many people do, of course, you know, morning, noon and night, really taking work home, working at weekends, all that thing, to actually relieve some of the stress of that, to actually take up a hobby or to do something that you've always said you wanted to do. Well, again, like many of your listeners, I'm an avid reader. I've always been a reader. Most writers were readers before they became writers. But I have, and I hopefully this never happens to anyone reading my books, but sometimes you pick up a book and you get a few chapters in and you think, hang on a minute, hang on, these characters are wooden. You could drive a coach and horses through this plot, and you put it down. And I often said to my husband, do you know, I'm sure I could do better than that. And he used to say, go on, do it, do it. But when I was on the management course, I thought, well, why not? Why not? Why not just give it a go? It can't be that difficult, I thought stupidly. So I literally got home that night. This is back in 2002. And I opened my laptop on the kitchen table, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I just wrote chapter one. And then I made up, it was a medieval story, so I made up about the hero and the heroine, et cetera, the usual thing. And I got about, I don't know, a chapter in, and suddenly this whole story burst into my head, and I could not stop writing. And to cut a long story short, really, I just carried on, and I wrote that book, and I wrote loads of others. I might tell you, though, truthfully, that book is still on my laptop. You know, it takes a while. It does. I mean, like anything you learn in life, it takes a while to perfect what you're doing. But I just kept writing, and I just love it so much. So, and as they say, the rest is history. You know, about five books later, I started submitting. I got rejections upon rejections, but I'm pretty stubborn. I mean, there's a lot of EastEnders are, and I won't give in. And I just kept going until I finally got myself an agent. And then from there, it was not easy, but it certainly helped me into the publishing world.
Mm. Oh, fantastic. Well done. So where did the idea of this ration book series come from?
Well, I've got to confess, I ruthlessly exploit my family. in the nicest possible way, because all of my family, all of the Fullertons have lived in East London since the 1820s. I've managed to trace them all back in various places, in various guises, and in various workhouses, I might say. But my immediate family, the family that I knew when I was growing up, my aunts, my uncle, my nan, my parents, all lived in East London, and they all lived through the Blitz in East London. They were adults, or very young adults, you know, they were 13, 14-year-olds. And they lived through the thick of the Blitz and the bombing around London docks. And so, you know, we heard stories as children about what they did. My dad was in the 8th Army across North Africa, then up into Italy. So in a way, a lot of it, although I haven't used any of them as any of the characters in my book, it's not easy to do that. But certainly the background and the feel of it are things that I've heard as long as I can remember as a child growing up. Some of the stories my dad told me about being in the army, some of the funny things that happened to him in a gun crew, I've incorporated that into some of my books as anecdotes for some of the heroes to tell about what they did in the war. So in a way, it's a labour of love, because it's all my family, all those family are long gone, but it brings them back to life in different ways.
How lovely to have all that family background that you can draw on for the books.
Yeah. Well, in a Russian book, Daughter, you see, my heroine, Cassie, actually gets stuck in the Bessemer Green tube disaster, which many people know about now. But, of course, during the war, nobody heard. Well, only the immediate people involved knew about it. It wasn't publicised clearly. But my mum was down there. She was one of those. She wasn't caught in the crash, but she had got on the platform to shelter about a half hour before it all happened. So her recollections of what happened and how it felt and smelt and all the sort of panic that was going on down there, actually, and I put into Cassie's book, really was the first-hand eyewitness account that my mum told me before she passed on.
Wow, amazing. So this book is obviously it's a series. Are they all standalone books though?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You can't expect authors. You can't expect readers. They might pick up the latest book. I mean, you pick up Russian Book Daughter, you could read it easily as a standalone. It's not fair to say it's one of a series that you've got to go back and buy all the rest. So, no, I think you always have to write a book. Any book you write, don't matter if it is part of a series, you have to write it as if that's the first book a reader picks up, because quite often it is. But you can read them out of, you can read all five of them out of sequence. I mean, if you're keen, I would suggest you do it in sequence, because you follow the Brogan family all the way through. But equally, if you find it in a shop somewhere by itself, pick it up and read it, you'll be perfectly fine. You won't think, oh, I don't know what's going on, or who are these people? Because, I'm very consciously aware when I'm writing a new book that I need to make sure the reader knows exactly what's going on and who everybody is.
Yeah. So do you know how many there's going to be in this series? Is it going to keep going?
Yeah. I've got a Christmas one coming out, which is a Russian Book Christmas Broadcast, which is a shorter story. I mean, it's still 35,000 words, so it's about 10 chapters. But they're a Christmas book. Sometimes people like to read Christmassy things, especially about the war. But then the last one, actually, I'm sad to find, I keep getting fans emailing me saying, oh, please don't finish the Brogans. I love the Brogans. But there's a point as a writer that you have to say, I've done it really. I mean, it's not to say I won't reprise it. I mean, I could move it on, and all the children in this series could end up being children, like teenagers and adults in the 50s. If my publishers were keen, certainly for the war had only a time span, and you've got to, as a historical writer, you've got to stick within that time span. So the last one, which is the Russian Book Victory, which won't be out till next year, but that's the one I'm actually just polishing off at the moment, and that'll be the last in this series. But people don't have to despair. There will be. I'm labelled by my publishers, not myself, I might say, as the queen of the Eastern sagas. But I love East London. I love the culture. It's a very working-class culture, and even if... Although I speak specifically about that culture, in a sense it translates to any working class culture in England, whether it be up north, the northeast, northwest, the Midlands. You know, it's that same feeling of community, the same feeling of shared care, you know, looking after a neighbour, looking after other people's children. There's a heavy emphasis on children and families and all that sort of stuff, which resonates through any working class or any structure of society, to be truthful.
Definitely. Salt of the earth, they say.
They are. But in a way, lots of those communities have gone now. And I think that's the popularity of sagas.
Yeah.
The Second World War. Because although many of us can't trace our children's ancestors, most of us have got photo albums with black and white pictures of people who fought in the war or went through the war. You know, it's touchable history, really.
Yeah.
And people love it. I mean, people love to read what their family and their forebears did. So, but there will be another East End series. There's no worry about that. There will be another. I'm not sure what it is yet, but I'm in conversation with my publishers. But
fantastic.
There definitely will be another one, yeah.
Great. Yeah. Well, for the moment, the latest book by Jean Fullerton is A Russian Book Daughter, and that is out now and available to buy on our website, tre.radio. Jean, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my absolute pleasure. I'm sorry if I've rattled on a little bit.
No, not at all. It's lovely.
It's lovely to... I say hello to all your listeners in Europe, actually, because we are great travellers, my husband and I. We try to get to Europe at least two or three times a year, and we haven't been to... We haven't come to meet you all for a long, long while. Well, we're looking forward to get back in that tunnel, I tell you, and shooting over to France or flying over to Greece and Spain and places like that, places that we go to more or less every year. So
yeah.
It won't be long. Hopefully,
fingers crossed,
it won't be long. Absolutely. But thank you for inviting me along. I'm so pleased to be speaking to you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Just Joining us on the line now is Kat Dunn, who grew up in London and has lived in Japan, Australia and France. She's written about mental health for Mind and The Guardian and has worked as a translator for Japanese television. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel. It's a young adult fantasy story called Monstrous Design. Welcome to the book show, Kat.
Hi, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So, how amazing living in Japan, Australia and France. I bet they're all very different.
yes, you could say that. Quite different experiences.
And working as a translator for Japanese television, does that mean you speak Japanese?
Yes, I did my undergraduate degree in Japanese. So I lived there for a few years and then worked briefly translating for NHK, which is sort of like the equivalent of the BBC in Japan. So at the Wimbledon tennis tournament, of all places.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. How interesting. So working for, I mentioned you've written about mental health and done a lot of work with Mind and things. There's been a lot of articles that have come out recently talking about the amount of youngsters who have been reading more in the past year or so during the pandemic. And I think it's becoming more and more widely known, thankfully, that reading can be extremely good for mental health.
I mean, yeah, I think anything that you find that helps your mental health is a great thing. I'm really glad a lot of people have found reading can do that for them. I think, at least from my own very specific perspective, I think reading gives you a sense of company when you're alone, which I suppose is probably an incredibly important thing in the last year, which sounds quite a simplistic thing, but I think the fact that you can have that quite intimate contact with an author and their imagination and their world, and a contact that, you know, hundreds of other people are also having, kind of creates a real sense of shared experience and shared humanity that I think we've all kind of sorely needed in this last year.
Yeah, definitely. So looking at your latest book, Monstrous Design, we're going right back to 18th century London and Paris. Why are you taking us there?
Why, indeed. The book is set around the events of the French Revolution. So that is in the 1790s. So that's what drew me back there. I really wanted to write about a revolutionary setting. And I really wanted to write not at the start of a revolution where everything's kind of hopeful and you're fighting the good fight. I wanted to go towards the end of a revolution where theoretically, the good fight has won, the revolution has won, but things are, you know, you hit the practicalities of actually trying to set up this new world you've imagined, and it all goes a bit horribly wrong. So I wanted to kind of go to that period and explore that kind of complex moral position of principle versus practicalities. And of course, if I'm going to be doing something in 1790s Paris, I couldn't not go to 1790s London, the kind of height of the Regency and decadence in Jane Austen. So it was too much of a good opportunity to miss.
Yeah. So before you started this book, did you already know a lot about this particular period in history, or did you have to do a lot of research for the book?
Probably half and half. I've always been a bit of a history nerd. I've always read historical novels. I've loved documentaries. I've read a lot of history, and I've kind of sucked it all up. And so I always had in my head this sort of vague mental map of what that period looked like, perhaps less so politically and more so in that kind of daily life experience. So I kind of had that I had that kind of creative vision in my head of what the world might look like. And then I went and did a lot of research into, the politics that were going on at the time. And then whatever I was interested in, whether it was fashion or the food or the science, whatever I needed for that bit of a novel, I'd then go and do a bit of a deep dive and research that particular thing.
And was it fun, the research?
It was a lot of fun. I think it was also quite challenging doing stuff set in France. I speak French, but then having to learn how to research in a second language was something I hadn't quite realised what a big challenge. Learning how to Google in French was probably the biggest challenge. it was a lot of fun, but it was sort of unexpected challenges came up.
Yeah. So what can you tell us about some of the characters in the book?
So our characters are led by girl called Camille, who is the head of the Battalion of the Dead, the Battalion de Mort, who are a group who kind of Scarlet Pimpernel-esque rescue people from the guillotine who have been unjustly convicted to death. So there's Camille, who is the kind of leader and the brains and kind of comes up with the plans. although they are not always as clever as she thinks they might be. And then there is her girlfriend, Ada, who is a scientist of the group, who uses her kind of specialist know-how to help them get out of tricky situations. There is Al, who's a disinherited aristocrat, who's slightly on the run from a warrant out on his own family, who uses all of his connections to gather intelligence for the group. And then there's Guy, who's an ex-soldier who's deserted and is working with the battalion to try and basically make up for that. So there's the four of them. And in the first book, they go and rescue a girl called Alamp, who turns out not to be an aristocrat and not necessarily not entirely human either. So she's the fifth member of the group. And then there is another character called James, who I won't tell you too much about because his arrival is a bit of a surprise to everybody, shall I say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I know you spent a lot of time on the characters. It was really important to you to have queer representation in fantasy young adult books. Is there a real lack of that, would you say, then?
I think these days more and more there's some really brilliant writers out there who are bringing queer characters into their fantasy writing. But I think at least for me, growing up, the most accessible queer narratives were often, they were contemporary, they might be coming out stories, they might be dealing with, you know, issues with your family. And I think quite often being queer was the kind of main point of the book. It was, and there's so much value in those stories, but for me, I've always loved fantasy, and I think there's so much value in sort of casual, incidental queerness, like, you know, people, LGBT people, their whole life, you're not walking around going, "Ha, today I am very gay." Well, maybe you are. you just kind of live your life and you just happen to also be gay.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That's really what I wanted to do with the book, was just kind of, well, there's a lot of queer people here. So what?
That's just part of the world. Yeah, good for you, good for you. And I understand that there's a bit of kind of, I'm trying to work out which bit, but there's connections between this and your own family story in terms of the representing strong pioneering women.
Yes, I mean, I suppose I was always going to be inspired a bit by my family and the people around me, but my family on my mother's side were part of the early trade union movement in South Wales in the mining communities. And so there was always a very strong revolutionary mood, shall we say. and a lot of women who sort of, I don't want to say pull themselves up by their bootstraps, because they certainly got a lot of help. So my grandmother, she was one of the people who got to go to grammar school from having lived in, you know, real poverty in the south of Wales. She got to grammar school and then she got to go be a teacher. And then she ended up doing an MPhil in screenwriting and things. So she had a real upward trajectory. But basically, that revolutionary spirit, you know, she was known for sort of saying about people she disliked, "Well, come the revolution, they'll be first up against the wall and shot." So there was a certain kind of strength of character that definitely came a lot to life in the characters in the book.
Yeah. So could this be a series, do you think? It sort of says to me that it could be part of a series.
Yes. So Dangerous Remedy was the first in the trilogy. Monstrous Design is the second. And the third one will be out next year. And I am currently working on it. And we haven't released a title yet, but hopefully we will soon. But yes, so it will be a trilogy in the end.
Great. And you're definitely stopping at three?
For now. I'll need a bit of a break after that point. I mean, who knows? Never say never. But I think three books has definitely been quite a big adventure.
Yeah. And when you started the first one, did you already know then that it was going to be a series?
Yeah, I really wanted to do a trilogy with it because it was really inspired by the kind of the period in history. So I the first book is sort of in the final days of Robespierre's rule in Paris, in France, and then you've obviously got a very bit quick turnaround where, this is no spoiler because it's just history, but Robespierre gets overthrown in the Thermidorian reaction, and then we kind of have a resurgence of, if not pure royalists, but definitely people on the other side of the political spectrum looking for revenge against all the Jacobins who'd enacted the terror and sent so many people to the guillotine. And in turn, they sent a lot of people to the guillotine. So there was this really interesting kind of shape of history where we got a real pivot from one figure to the next phase of history. And so I always wanted to have three books that kind of spanned last days, the fall of Robespierre, and then what comes next.
There's a lot of material there, isn't there?
Yeah, There's a lot someone could do with that, and so much you could write.
Yeah, great. Well, if people want to get a copy of Monstrous Design, it is the latest book out by Kat Dunn. And what was the first one called? Is it good for people to read that one first?
So the first book is Dangerous Remedy. You could start with Monstrous Design, but I always think it's fun to start with the first book, just because one of the things I enjoyed most was getting to develop all the characters on from book one. So you could read Monstrous Design as a standalone, but why not read the first one too?
Yeah, absolutely. Good advice. Kat Dunn, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.